Greetings and welcome to Tales from the Otherwood, a podcast exploring the folk tales and folklore of the East Midlands and beyond. I'm Dylan Knight, and I'll be your guide as we take one of the many paths in this magical, ever-changing woodland. The Roots of the Otherwood takes us once again to England's smallest county, where we shall listen to our second tale of Rutland's most famous son, Geoffrey Hudson. If you haven't already listened to the story of Geoffrey Hudson, the boy in the pie, I would recommend you listen to that tale first, otherwise this one isn't going to make a lot of sense. We shall also find the roots of the Otherwood growing across the seas, for this tale takes us briefly away from the shores of Great Britain and to those of France. Tales from the Otherwood presents The Queen's Dwarf. Geoffrey Hudson was 10 years old, and he was on a mission. He watched the sea waves froth and part as the ship made its way. He was a little scared, but also very excited to be on a ship, especially as this was his very first time ever of being at sea. There were so many colours to the sea he hadn't expected. Greys, blues, greens, and how the brine foamed up against the ship's bow. Geoffrey had never seen the sea before. He had only ever heard about it in stories, poems, and plays, but here he was on a real-life adventure. He looked up and saw the blue skies streaked with white cloud and very nearly lost his footing when the ship dipped to the port side. Luckily for him, Jeanne Garnier, Queen Henrietta Maria's Master of Ceremonies, had already anticipated Geoffrey would fall and hurt himself, and so picked him up promptly.
"Come, young master, let us below deck, we?"
Geoffrey agreed, and was about to ask 101 questions when he noticed one of the sailors looking at them with a grim face. His dark eyes matched his dark beard, glistening with an inner heat as he looked upon them both with scorn.
"It's not right," the sailor muttered. "All this because the Queen has no fancy of our own midwives and nurses."
Garnier told Geoffrey to ignore him and whispered in French into Geoffrey's ear that the sailor was a stupid idiot. Geoffrey giggled knowingly. Because he was so small, he was no stranger to either being stared at or being called a whole manner of names by the common folk. Geoffrey had counted himself lucky, since coming into the possession of the Queen, he was showered with her unbridled affection. He was the prize jewel, the Queen's dwarf, no less, in her collection of dogs, dwarfs, and one giant. This last was his friend, William Evans, who stood 7 foot and 6 inches tall. He liked Will, who told him stories of Wales and the Welsh people. They both amazed the court with a show that was devised when Geoffrey first went to live with the Queen. William would wander about on stage, carrying a large stick of bread, finding at last somewhere to sit and enjoy his lunch. And then he would pull Geoffrey out of one of his pockets and popped him between the split bread, and with both hands holding his food, Evans would make as though he was to eat Geoffrey as a sandwich. And the court absolutely loved it. In his time with the Queen, Geoffrey was dressed in good finery and was being educated in reading, writing, mathematics, and how to behave in court. He even had his own servant, Jeremy. Geoffrey was taught to speak French, as Henrietta Maria did not have a good grasp of English. He was shown off and feted out at every given opportunity and every occasion. Everyone was impressed at this rarity of nature, not only for his size, but his charming manner and entertaining wit. The Queen adored him, and he loved her, seeing Henrietta Maria as his own mother. And now here he was, on a mission with other emissaries of the Queen to collect, by Her Majesty's request, Madame Perron, the best midwife in all of France. The Queen was pregnant again, and after the birth and death of her first child, she was taking no chances, not this time. Not after the first birth, which had the elderly midwife faint as she was so nervous at being surrounded by royalty. 2 days later, the embassy had arrived at the Parisian court with great aplomb. There was dancing and music, feasting with sweetmeats of every kind. Both Jean Garnier and Rocan, the Queen's dancing master, whom was also here to represent the Queen, seemed to be having a very good time in seeing old friends once again. On more than one occasion, the two courtiers had told Geoffrey it was a joy to drink good wine once again. French wine, that is. Geoffrey was in his element, as he was seen as an absolute delight by the French court. They loved his small size, loved his courteous and playful manner, and loved he had been educated in their tongue. Looks like the English could do something right after all. Even the Queen's mother, Marie de Medici, fawned over him as well as the other ladies of the court. All of them showered him with gifts of the expensive kind. Jewels, trinkets of gold and silver, all of them worth around £2,000. More gifts were given for the Queen as well, and they were worth a lot more. A few days later, on the 18th of March, Geoffrey found himself on another ship that had just left Calais and was bound back home for England. He had found on the previous trip that the voyage took only hours. It was the carriage trips on the land that took the longer time. Soon enough, the ship's captain, Master Pierre Griel, gave the orders for them to raise anchor and cast off. He even informed the Queen's embassy that they would be in England in but a few hours. 2 hours had passed. The embassy had not just gained the company of Madame Perron. Now, they had a very large party of people, which included 10 Capuchin friars, 29 priests, a dozen nuns, a young bishop, and a number of the Queen's handmaidens. The handmaidens were paying Geoffrey a lot of attention, saying how doll-like he was, how adorable and lovely he was, and he, in turn, was making them all laugh and being the star of his own show just for them. There seemed to be something that concerned the crew, and yet the audience around Geoffrey ignored them. It wasn't their business after all. Until they were interrupted by Jean Garnier, telling them all to get below deck and hide. Hide as quickly as they could. Everyone of the embassy quickly made their way down to the ship's hold. Everyone was in a bit of a panic, and the word Dunkerque was being bandied around. Geoffrey, in the confusion, was lifted and carried by Garnier, who held him close. As Garnier and Geoffrey made their way down, Geoffrey could see the crew were handing each other swords and pistols, and others were urging some of the priests down the stairs into the belly of the ship. "What's happening, Monsieur Garnier?" Geoffrey asked, sensing something was wrong. "The crew has spotted another vessel heading for us," Garnier said very seriously. "Is that why everyone is saying Dunkirk? What does it mean?" Geoffrey demanded to know. "It means Dunkirk pirates, Master Geoffrey. If they come aboard, they will take all of our valuables, the Queen's presents, and will hold us for ransom. Now, let us hide and hope that we can outrun them." Everyone in the hold kept as quiet as they could, hoping beyond hope that the Dunkirk pirates would be too slow and not catch them up. They even dared to hope they might be so close to England that the Dunkirkers would turn away. After agonizing moments of silence that seemed to stretch into hours, they could hear shouting both from the crew and other voices. Geoffrey, like all the others, jumped as soon as he heard the boom of the cannons. There were terrible noises of wood being smashed into pieces and ripped apart, of crewmen screaming, gunfire exploding above deck, and was shortly followed by scrabbling on the ship's side, and then there was the noise of metal clashing of blade against blade. The battle seemed to go on for eternity and seemed over far too soon. There was victorious yelling and laughing, and soon enough the stairs leading below deck were thundering with the running footsteps of the shouting and cackling dreaded Dunkirk pirates. The handmaidens and nuns screamed as the pirates grabbed them, either lifting them up over their shoulders or dragging them to their feet, ripping both dress and habit. The priests, the monks, the bishop and Madame Perron were all forced above deck too. The pirates saw Garnier, Geoffrey and Rocan and jeered at them as soon as they cast their eyes upon them. Rocan broke down screaming as he fell onto his knees, tears running down his face as he pleaded for mercy. One pirate grabbed him by his hair and smashed his face with the guard of his sword. Geoffrey had only ever seen blood from small cuts and the time he fell out of the window. He had never seen a man's nose explode with blood before. The three were taken above deck, and as the pirates saw how small Geoffrey was, they jeered some more and laughed, appearing to make clucking sounds at him like a chicken. Looking away, Geoffrey could see through the blurring of his tears the pirates had rounded up what was left of the crew and had them kneeling on the deck. The central mast had been destroyed and was leaning into the sea. The ship's captain hung his head in shame at having lost. There was more blood on the deck, and the pirates were now throwing bodies of the dead overboard. The last of the pirates from below deck whistled loudly as he and one of his filthy fellows brought up one of the coffers and opened it to the crew. Geoffrey recognised this as one of the presents for Queen Henrietta Maria. Somehow, he managed to slip Jean Garnier's grasp and went running towards the pirates. "No, that's not for you, that's for the Queen," he yelled as loud as he could. "No, Geoffrey, no," Garnier called after him. The pirates thought this was hilarious and laughed at the tiny boy heading towards them who dared to defy them. One pirate pulled out his sword and brought the blade down before Geoffrey, stopping him in his tracks. Shaking in his boots, Geoffrey looked at the man with his dark unkempt hair and unshaven face. There was something in this pirate's green eyes that held him transfixed. The pirate looked down at him and took his sword from the deck and pointed towards Garnier. "Go, English," he said, indicating for the boy to turn back. But Geoffrey couldn't move. Garnier quickly walked up to Geoffrey, cradling him to his breast like the scared child he was, and brought him back to the other prisoners. Some of the pirates laughed loudly, until the green-eyed man silenced these seedy-bound rogues and began telling the pirates what to do. Geoffrey could hear them speak, but did not understand what they were saying. It was a language he did not know, but he found himself, Garnier, Rocan, Madame Perron, the captain, along with several of the handmaidens and all 12 of the nuns, were sent across to the Dunkirker ship. Everyone was searched, and Geoffrey was in tears as all of his gifts from the French court were taken away from him, powerless as he was to stop them from doing anything to him and the others taken captive. 2 days later, Geoffrey, along with the other prisoners, had arrived in England. Geoffrey was very happy to be home and was met with an embrace from the heavily pregnant Queen. It was revealed that the Dunkirk pirates had released all of their captives after the governor of Calais had seized all Flemish people and goods as soon as they discovered the party had been captured. It seems that in the message to the pirates, they had suddenly realised their mistake in taking the royal embassy hostage and so released them, leaving them to find their own way back to Calais. From there, they were given safe passage to England. Both the king and queen replaced Geoffrey's stolen gifts and threw a great party for the embassy and those they had brought with them. Geoffrey was very glad to be home and was very happy once Henrietta Maria had delivered her very healthy baby boy, Charles, thanks to the help of Madame Perron. He was happy to be the queen's dwarf once again as he posed before the artist who painted his portrait. And even though he was but a child, he had now seen the real world again. It was rough, and it was harsh, and this would not be the first time it would reappear in his life. Right. Storytelling is thirsty work. Time for a cup of tea, I think. Put on the kettle or crack open your flask. It's time for a drink and a chat. Person with dwarfism, short person, short stature, or little person are the titles acceptable in our time in regards of what to call people who live with dwarfism, or better yet, call them by their name. Language is organic and is always evolving, always changing. Different people and communities have different preferred terms, and also some of what I'm going to talk about could touch on upsetting themes for some listeners. So please do forgive me if any of my words don't land right with you today, wherever you are. And if you feel the need, please do contact me with any feedback. In regards to this story, The Queen's Dwarf was the official title given to Geoffrey as soon as he became Queen Henrietta Maria's servant, and this is why I have kept this in the tale. People with dwarfism, from medieval times through to the 17th century, were considered otherworldly and outlandish. They were seen as a form of entertainment, and most were displayed at fairs in cages so people could see them as a spectacle. They were shown to the public as changelings, as it was common belief back then that fairies stole human children, replacing them with their own kind. In a different approach to this episode's chat, I feel it would be entirely inappropriate to discuss the folklore of changelings, and we'll save that for when we encounter a tale that directly involves them. I will instead go into some myths about Geoffrey Hudson himself, as there was a lot written about him that wasn't true. During his time in the royal court, Hudson was considered a marvel, a spectacular living doll of the Queen that could entertain in both performance and in witty discussion. Although we might not think today of owning someone as property, with or without a condition of any kind, it was fashionable at the time of the courts of Europe to present people with dwarfism as status symbols. Outdated attitudes such as these can help us to learn from the mistakes of the past and to develop compassion and equality in ourselves. Geoffrey Hudson, at this point in his life, was first and foremost a child, and he gained a reputation for being clumsy, as children can be. The incident at Denmark House involving him falling from a window was serious enough for Queen Henrietta Maria to cancel all of her appointments and social engagements and send for the very best physician to make sure Hudson would indeed survive. And he did. There are no exact details as to how he fell from the window or how he had not seriously hurt himself, but from whatever injury he suffered, he made a quick recovery. This incident led writers to invent other stories, such as how one day when he was washing himself in his basin and nearly drowned, leading Henrietta Maria to order him to wash in nothing larger than a coffee cup. Despite England's first coffee house opening almost 20 years after this incident was supposed to have taken place. Another story tells us how Hudson was almost blown into the Thames by a sudden strong wind, and he saved himself by grabbing onto a nearby bush. And so, Henrietta Maria, after holding a council, ordered him to have lead weights put into his shoes. Despite there being no records for lead being attached to any of his footwear whatsoever. There was even a farcical poem based on his encounter with the Dunkirk pirates, written by William d'Avenant, godson to one William Shakespeare. Jeffredos, or The Captivity of Geoffrey, was a popular poem written in two parts. It involves Geoffrey being taken from a small one-sail boat and then being accused by a Spanish pirate captain of being a spy. Geoffrey is then left, abandoned to make his way to Brussels, and is further terrorised by a very large turkey until he is rescued by a French midwife. Even the folktale of the boy in the pie takes creative licence with the truth. It was, in fact, the Duchess of Buckingham whom was curious about the tiny boy in Oakham and had him brought to Burley to see for herself and have him as her own for the purposes of status. The events of Geoffrey being presented to the King and Queen in a pie crust, however, did indeed happen, all as a show orchestrated by the Duke of Buckingham to win the Queen's favour. Already, Geoffrey Hudson's life was incredible. In each of these examples was a grain of truth. Geoffrey was a small child of 18 inches in height. He was acquired by nobility as a living keepsake and was given to royalty as a peace offering. He had an accident that pulled the Queen's attention from her duties and was indeed captured by pirates. And yet, he was a muse to writers and poets that made him into something else, someone to be lampooned and caricatured. Stories like these stay in the public consciousness. They become gossip, which becomes a story, which becomes urban myth, which becomes legend. If it is one thing our exploration into folk tales and folklore have shown us, it is that every story has an element of truth within it. Another thing they have shown us through the examples given about Geoffrey Hudson is that real-life events can become stories and tales in their own right. We see this all the time with books and films that are based on true events. And who is not to say this is how folk tales are created in the first place? Tales from the Otherwood was written and produced by me, Dylan Knight. If you could please leave a review of this podcast wherever you listen to it, I'd appreciate that a lot, as it helps other people find my show. The roots of the Otherwood grow far and wide in this world and in the next. If you would like to share any tales, traditions, and folklore of wherever you are from, you can contact me by email at talesfromtheotherwood@gmail.com. or Instagram at tales_from_the_otherwood. Thank you for listening, and remember, stay safe and watch out for the unexpected.